The first step is to actually define and document what that target market is, which most people don't do. And a lot of the reason that people don't document what the target market is because a lot of CEOs believe that's limiting, right? Well, I don't want to define the market as only CFOs of Fortune 500 companies are in the process of raising debt because I feel our addressable market should be bigger than that. So it's a broader definition. That almost never helps. I think the first step is to define the target market realistically and as specifically as possible.
Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. What we do on this show is we find the world's leading entrepreneurs and CEOs, and we spend about a half hour with them and really dig into their story. We want to understand the strategies and the tips and the tools that they use to make big happen in their business. And by the end of each episode, you'll have actionable ideas that you can implement on your path to big success. To learn more about CEO Coaching International and how we can help you dramatically grow your business, visit us at CEOCoachingInternational.com. Do sales and marketing have to be at odds with each other? Hi, everybody. Welcome to the CEO Coaching International podcast. I'm your host, Steve Sandusky. My guest today is Mike Morris. Mike is a principal at Kettle Hole Partners, which is a company that helps you optimize your marketing results based on detailed tracking of the numbers. Prior to that, he headed up customer acquisition and retention at Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. In today's show, we discuss how to align sales and marketing to optimize your growth. And we wrap up with Mike's take on how sales and marketing will evolve in light of artificial intelligence. With that, please enjoy my conversation with Mike Morris. Oftentimes, we see in companies that there's a tension between sales and marketing, in that sales blames marketing for not giving us good leads, and marketing blames sales for not closing the leads that we're sending you. And I know you and I would be in agreement that marketing and sales need to be in alignment. So give me a little context about the importance of sales and marketing being in alignment.
Yeah, as you point out, the dynamic that you mentioned is very common. And that really is one of the core symptoms of a misalignment between sales and marketing. When it really comes down to it, the alignment between sales and marketing ensures that your organization is set up to generate sales and customers most efficiently. It sounds very simple and very obvious, but without really solid alignment between your marketing efforts, your sales efforts, and really your target customer, you can end up running really off kilter in a number of ways.
Now, how do you define being in alignment or being out of alignment? What does that actually mean?
So the way I define that is that both marketing and sales believe their target customer, which sounds simple and sounds like it would always be the case, but it isn't. So for example, if your customer is Fortune 500 CFOs who are in the process of raising debt, your marketing efforts need to be aligned with figuring out who those people are talking to, what they're listening to, how do you get in front of them when they're having those conversations. Your marketing efforts should not be focused on, you know, if you're a debt provider, just generally reaching out and ranking highly on debt terms and things like that, right? So ensuring that everybody is operating on the same playbook and everybody's targeting the same target market specifically.
And do you find in companies, how are they structured from a leadership standpoint in terms of, do sales and marketing typically, both of those divisions report up to the same leader? So ultimately there's one person up there that can make sure that both divisions are in alignment, or how do people typically internally structure the leadership of those two areas?
That's something that's been changing. So the traditional way is that sales and marketing would report up to different leaders that may then in fact report separately to the CEO, you know, a head of sales and a head of marketing, regardless of what you call them from a title perspective. There is a movement or more of a dynamic recently to go towards what's commonly referred to as a chief revenue officer. And that is the person who brings together those marketing and sales functions into one function and can help drive that alignment. So when you have a common chief over both of those functions, you're probably more likely to be aligned, but you can still see some misalignment in those cases. When those functions report separately up to the CEO, I think you have a much higher chance of being misaligned.
And if you do have a chief revenue officer at your company, when we think of sales and we think of marketing, those are really two different skill sets and two different mentalities. So how are companies thinking about filling the position of the chief revenue officer? Are you seeing people are leaning more toward sales-oriented people that they put in that role? Are they leaning more toward marketing, or does it just depend on the company and the industry that they're in and the way that they actually generate new clients?
The fundamental answer is it depends, but I've seen one trend or one tendency that I think is interesting. The larger the customer and the smaller number of customers that the company targets, right? So big deal size, large customers, they tend to fill, if they have a chief revenue officer, that tends to be filled with a salesperson, someone who came up as a salesperson, which makes sense in that case, right? Because the fundamental thing you're doing there is you're selling, you're doing large account sales, and marketing for the most part prepares material and for the most part, you know, does air cover in order to really help those sales conversations. If on the other hand, the company is targeting, you know, I'll use a very specific example, business to business SaaS, that chief revenue officer more than likely came up through the marketing or the growth side of things, because that function is the one that's always thinking about new customers, and the new customer sales process there is tends to be more automated and a little bit more high volume. So I've seen some of that. It is a little over the board, depending on what that is. If you look at a chief revenue officer job description, it will either be SaaS customer growth or large account sales. Like that's kind of how it seems to break out.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense, because if you're in a business where you can sell people purely online, where you really don't have to have a human in the conversation there, like right. One of the companies you used to work with,
yes.
Grasshopper, which we'll talk about here in just a little bit. But you can do that all digitally. You can do that all online. And so really, that's really all about marketing. But like you say, if it's a perhaps low volume, but high dollar, where you have to have a human in to actually build relationships, make the sale. Like if I'm selling Boeing airplanes,
right.
I'm probably going to need to have humans in there. And I need a salesperson, because that is a long sales cycle. And it's a big dollar amount. And it doesn't happen all that often.
It doesn't happen all that often. And marketing has a very different function in a company like that, right? If you think about Boeing, marketing is about supporting the salespeople. It's about creating the overall brand for Boeing to consumers as well as to customers. And so it's a very different function than sales in that case. But the good way to think about it, right? It tends to be one or the other.
What are some signs that would indicate that a company is misaligned when it comes to sales and marketing, that we got a problem that we got to fix here?
Some of the most obvious ones are missed revenue goals. If you keep missing sales goals, you keep missing lead gen goals, depending on what metric you're looking at, that can be a sign that they're misaligned. Low win rates. So you're generating leads, you're generating conversations, you're generating meetings, but you can't close those deals, right? That can be a sign that things are misaligned. The more qualitative signs, frustration between sales and marketing, as you opened up the conversation, you know, marketing saying, oh my gosh, we generate all these leads and sales can't close them, and sales, these leads are no good and we can't close them. That kind of tension can be a sign of that. And then the result of that dynamic can often be high employee churn. So if you can't keep good salespeople and or good marketing people in the organization, that can also be a sign that the two functions are not aligned.
And how do you think about marketing in terms of how marketing can generate leads that come in at different parts of the funnel? For example, we can have some marketing that brings people in at the top end of the funnel where they're like not qualified at all yet, but we got a name, we got an email address, versus they come in maybe toward the bottom of the funnel where these are people pretty well qualified because they've gone through a number of steps here. And now maybe we can get the human involved to actually do the final close. So how do you think about marketing's role in bringing people in at different points on the funnel?
Well, I think marketing does have a role at all those different points. I think one of the things that's most important in that case is that you have a consistent definition of what those points actually are. So as basic as that sounds, that is often not the case. You can actually have different areas in marketing calling different lead stages different things. For example, maybe somebody calls a lead simple interest in the product, responded to a white paper, they attended a webinar, they picked up the phone, right? Maybe that's a lead in one case. Whereas sales might say, no, a lead is somebody that actually has budget and actually has a project and is actually in the market. There's marketing qualified leads and sales qualified leads. But I think one of the ways you can sort of run off the reservation is if you don't have a common definition of what those stages are, it's very difficult then to understand where marketing's playing, because marketing does bring people in over the spectrum of those stages, but it's, you have to be very clear about where that person entered. Just because they just entered the funnel doesn't necessarily mean they entered at the very top. So I think there's a role there for marketing in all those stages. The key in my mind is always making sure you've clearly defined what those stages are and everybody's operating from the same set of stages.
What are some of your thoughts on how we can align the company toward the target market that we have to make sure marketing is clear on that, to make sure the sales team is clear on that, and everything is pointing in the right direction to get the ideal clients, the ideal client persona that we're after here?
The first step is to actually define and document what that target market is, which most people don't do. And a lot of the reason that people don't document what the target market is because a lot of CEOs believe that's limiting. Right. Well, I don't want to define the market as only, in my case before, CFOs of Fortune 500 companies are in the process of raising debt, because I feel our addressable market should be bigger than that. So it's a broader definition. That almost never helps. I think the first step is to define the target market realistically and as specifically as possible. I'll use the example of Grasshopper that you mentioned earlier as a case of defining a target market. Grasshopper, it's a SaaS company that sells telecommunication software, and it sells telecommunications software to very small companies, often very new companies, right? So the entrepreneur market, the very small business market. Now, there are tens of millions of small businesses in the country, and tens of millions of new businesses are started every year and go out of business every year. Now, you could very broadly say Grasshopper's market is all those tens of millions of businesses. And that sounds really big, and it makes markets sound very attractive, but that really wasn't our target market. That was the outline of our target market, but our real target market were those small businesses who were looking for a professional presence for one reason or another. They could be a roofer, they could be a consultant, they could be a law office, but for one reason or another, they were looking for a professional, and that was what they got out of the phone numbers that Grasshopper sold. And they tended to operate remotely, so they didn't sit in the same place all day. So it wasn't a pizza place or a deli or a place like that, because they would just have a regular phone. So as you start to peel back the layers and really understand why somebody buys your product or service, find what that target market is very specifically and help everybody in the organization understand what that is. Because then you can start to talk about, how do those people buy? Who do they listen to? What influences them? And how are we going to go after that? And that's the very basis for how you start to get that alignment.
We hear the words target market and ideal client persona or client persona. Do you view those as one and the same, or do you view them as two different things? And if they're different, how do you distinguish between them?
The way I think about it, an ideal client persona is an example of somebody in the target market. If I said our target market, Grasshopper, again, it's one I'm very familiar with, is businesses who are looking for a professional presence for one reason or another. One of the personas of that are home services companies that are passing from one generation to the next. The dad hands the business to a son or a daughter, and that child says, okay, I've got the business now. I'm going to do this at the next level. I'm going to step things up. And as part of that, I'm going to get us an 800 number so that we can reach people outside of our area or whatever they're looking for. But it's that type of a mentality, right? So the way I think about it, the persona is really Joe or Susan, the second generation home services owner, whereas the target market is those small businesses that are looking for a more professional presence.
Would it be fair to say that pretty much every company that does marketing should have both a target market and then further qualify that by having a client persona within that target market?
I think so, because the target market is obviously critical. The persona makes it real for people. It's much easier to think in terms of Joe or Susan when you understand what their needs and their wants are.
Another term that we hear thrown around is total addressable market, or TAM. And I think that's popular in the Silicon Valley type companies. Is that something that you think about too? How does that connect to what the target market is? Should we even be thinking about the total addressable market?
I think you do at a certain point. So the way I think about the TAM is an important thing to think about when you are considering different markets you could address with your product or service or different products or services. And bigger isn't necessarily always better in that case. The way I think about the TAM, it's the total number of participants in the market times whatever the price is that you charge, right? That's the simple way that I think about it. You could think about it also just as in the total amount that people spend, but I think it's a little more actionable when you think about it in terms of how much you charge. So I'll go back to the Grasshopper case. We charged about $35 a month. Let's say there were 10 million, there were more than that, but I'll just say 10 million. That makes our TAM, 35 times 10 million or $350 million a month, right? It's kind of a crazy number. But again, that's why I think you need to then be much more specific about it. I think the TAM is useful to screen categories, markets, services to say, is this a big enough market? Is it too big a market to play in? Which can happen because one of the simplest rules of marketing is the person that spends the most tends to win. And so if you're playing in a market with people that spend 100 times what you do, they're probably win at the end of the day. So if you define the market so that you are now that person, you can win, right? So again, that's how do I think about the two coming back. So I think it's a data point, but I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that once you've made the decision to go into a particular market.
As a result of the internet and digital marketing, we now have a lot of data that we can track and we can measure. So talk to me about the importance of measurement in tracking and gathering data as it relates to the sales and marketing process.
So I think that's a very important part of this in getting alignment between sales and marketing. So once you've defined the target market, once you've defined the sales process, the qualification process, whatever process you're looking at from the point someone becomes aware of your product to the point they purchase it, it's really important to understand where within that process do things actually change and where can you control things. So I'll go back to the Grasshopper case again. When you think about a SaaS offering, you can sell products, right? So get more customers. You can sell the same number of products at a higher price, or you can lose fewer customers, right? Every SaaS company loses customers. In Grasshopper's case, what we learned through extensive testing is the average price people paid didn't change. We had very little room to change what people paid, and it had to do with the nature of the market or the nature of the service. We also were operating at a customer rate that was very similar to the rate at which small businesses go out of business. So, if you're selling to small businesses that go out of business, you can't really change the churn rate to be much less than the rate at which people go out of business because the market fundamentally goes away. So, what that left us with was new customers. And that measure became the most important. So, everything about new customers, the conversion rate of different customers from different sources, the cost of customers from different sources. If changes in churn rate across different customers from different sources, that was important too. But it all came down to new customers for us. And that's what we spent our time measuring. And we didn't worry so much about metrics because we knew over experience that they didn't really change. And so we'd check in on them once in a while to make sure nothing fundamentally shifted. But, I guess the nut of this is measure what matters. And that means you're not going to measure everything. You have to figure out what really matters and what really drives the business and focus your measurement effort on those. Because one of the problems you do have is with all of this data that is available, you can just get drowned in it and you can end up with data and information that just isn't helpful.
Which was what I was going to ask you about in terms of there is so much data out there, and you're saying, hey, identify what are the most meaningful metrics that you need to track here. But how do you actually track them? Meaning, is it like in a spreadsheet that you have this? Is there software out there that takes all this data in and then you can run reports to see what your conversion rates are and that sort of thing? Or how are we physically tracking this stuff and measuring it?
So that's very dependent on the situation. So the short answer is yes to all of those things. There is software. There's a ton of different BI systems that you can purchase. There's a lot of different things that will track web traffic and attribution and other things like this. But I take the same philosophy with this as I do with measurement. Figure out what really matters for the business and don't worry yourself about trying to solve everything, right? So again, like if you think about attribution, attribution's a hot topic, especially online. Well, somebody sees Facebook or Instagram. They click on an ad on AdWords, but maybe they heard a radio ad too. What's the actual reason that they went and became a lead or purchased your product? That matters, but it only matters on the margin. And I don't mean on the margin being small. I mean, it only matters when you change something. So the way that I always approach that and the way that I try to collect the data is by testing. I want to understand if offline media ads actually drive more customers. I will construct a test where I run those ads only in certain geographies, and I will then see what that difference is. And then I know that's the data that I have to track. And unfortunately, a lot of that is manual, to get back to directly answer your question, right? So I think that there is still a lot of manual data collection and analysis that's necessary. But if you focus that on only the metrics that really matter, it becomes a lot less onerous and not nearly as daunting as thinking you have to track everything.
I know you were one of the masterminds behind Grasshopper in terms of all the digital stuff that they did and just the massive growth that they had through all of the organic growth in your marketing efforts. So I'm wondering, how does a company decide whether they can do that kind of stuff in-house? Because it's a real skill and things change quickly and Google changes their algorithm, or instead of, getting all 30% of my traffic from AdWords or pay-per-click, now it's 10% because something changed. So how does a company think about whether they should build that capability in-house versus whether they should outsource it to an agency?
That's a great question. And I think that that question changes over the course of a company's life, and it changes depending on how important and scalable that channel is. So that's how I always think about the in-source versus outsource decision. I'll use Grasshopper. We invested heavily in SEO and content development and content strategy in-house. We believed that that was a key tenet of our growth and strategy, and also a key tenet of our brand. And so, from a very early stage, we did that and we did that in-house and we hired the best people and we did all of that ourselves. We ran paid ads, AdWords mostly in the day. We had it in-house, we had it out of house. And really, what that turned out to be for us was a channel that was important, but not scalable. In that particular market, we couldn't go from spending $40,000 a month to $500,000 a month on AdWords. That's just not how the market worked. And because it wasn't a scalable channel that was going to massively influence our growth, we outsourced that. We also found a very specific kind of outsourcing that worked very well for us. We didn't use an agency. We used an actual person who, in this particular case, ran PPC for a very large retailer and was doing our account on the side. So this person had experience running PPC for catalogs of thousands of products. So our three plans was very easy for her to kind of conceptualize and run as kind of an independent contractor. And we had a lot of success with that because it was like an extension of our team, but it was an extension of our team that we only had to pay fractionally for. And so that worked very well for us in that particular case. But I think really it comes down to how scalable is that channel? And then the other dimension I would say is how proven is it? So Grasshopper scaled massively with a national radio campaign. That is a whole different skill set. Like media buying and understanding how all that works is a very challenging and expensive function to build in-house. Very few people do that in-house. And, we certainly weren't going to try to do that until we knew that that worked. So when we started that process, we tested that using outside buyers and outside assistants to do that over time. And we ended up selling the company before we got to this point. We probably would have brought some of that expertise in-house, but because we proved that it was a scalable channel and one that could drive significant growth.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that you had the radio strategy with Grasshopper, because I remember a few years ago, Grasshopper was everywhere. It's like Grasshopper, the entrepreneur's phone system. So
Yep.
you can't forget it. But now it's like, where are they? And I know you mentioned that the company was sold, so maybe they have a different strategy these days, and you're obviously not there anymore to really drive all of that, but it appears that things have changed. So anything else here in terms of how do we align the organization to the target market? I know you talked about measurement. You talked a little bit about testing. Is there anything else with testing or anything else that we need to think about in that area?
To recap on that, I think it's about first definition and alignment on the target market, understanding of what activities matter to drive people from awareness through purchase and the measurement then of those activities. I would say also the communication of those activities. That's another key point. Everybody in the organization should know what matters and what's going on in those cases, right? How many new customers did we get? You know, whatever the key numbers are, be published widely. And then testing. You need to test everything. We'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to Grasshopper. But I think one of the biggest things is, you know, to not be afraid to test new things and to celebrate the failure of those tests, even though that sounds like a strange thing to say. It's really important to make it more than okay for tests to not work, because as a leader, you're looking for your people in your organization to generate ideas that can grow the company and the new ideas to reach the target market and new ideas to grow revenue. And people don't generate ideas like that if they're afraid they all have to succeed. So it's very important that people understand that tests are just that, they're tests, and they need to be able to fail without it being a problem for the people.
I want to segue here for just a second, because sure. I hear a lot of people talk about, let's celebrate the failures. And just to your point, you just eloquently stated why it makes sense. Like, we want to encourage people to test things because that's how we're going to grow. And we want to celebrate that you're testing things and whatnot. Maybe this is just a nuance, but to me, wording matters. And so when I hear people say, well, we need to celebrate our failures, how I read that is we're recognizing and we're rewarding people for failing. So what are we going to get? We're going to get more failures. And so the little twist that I think about that is, rather than saying we celebrate the failures, it's like we don't penalize the failures, because we don't really want more failures. We want more victories. And so we don't want people to feel like I can get complacent and try a test and not try super hard to make sure I do the right tests here to get the results, because they're going to celebrate my failure anyway. So there's no penalty. So it's maybe it's just a little nuance. Maybe I'm just a little too deep on that. You have any thoughts on just the framing of that?
I understand what you're saying. I think that's a fair point. At Grasshopper, we got up every quarter and we talked to the whole company. We shared everything that we said we were going to do, what we actually did, what we didn't do. We had a very disciplined process where we were required 4 or 5 tests are going to run every single quarter. Not really more than that, because you couldn't test things at higher volumes than that, but every quarter we did that. And so every quarter we get up and we would say what worked and what didn't. And I would tend to make light of it. So I didn't say, go fail. But what I would say is, listen, here are the tests we ran. Yeah, it would have been great if one of them had worked. These are the reasons why we think they didn't work. But it's really important that we learned that those 5 things don't drive customer growth. So we learned something from those tests. And we now know we don't have to spend more money in those areas because those areas don't work. And so I would talk about it like that very openly and very frankly, so that people knew, even though a test ran and we didn't get the result we wanted, we still learned something, which was the point of the test. And therefore it was a success. So people still had to think, well, what do I want to learn from this test I'm suggesting? What do I think's going to happen, right? Which is really all I wanted them to do. And if they did that, and again, people didn't necessarily run their own tests. The team would say, oh, here's 3 things I think we would test. We'd take it into a planning session. We'd come up with 4 or 5 of them. So there was some vetting that happened. But fundamentally, what I wanted to do is continue to get those lists from the team. So,
yeah. And I like the way that you frame that in terms of it's not that we're like giving you a bonus because you failed on all of these tests. It's more around, we had a hypothesis. We think that if we do this particular test, that it's going to drive results. We won't know until we try. We right. tried, it didn't work. So here's what we learned from it. So it's not that we're celebrating that we failed. It's about, we tested a hypothesis, didn't work. Here's the learning. We're not going to make that mistake again. And we're going to take that learning. It's going to accumulate over time with all of the learnings. So we're going to get smarter and smarter and smarter, so that we may do 5 tests now and only 1 out of the 5 has worked in the past, because of all these accumulated learnings, now in the future, maybe 2 out of the 5 are going to work because we've gotten smarter about what didn't work and how to do better tests. And yes. So we get 2 out of 5 hits or 3 out of 5 hits. So maybe that's a way to think about it too.
Yeah, I think that's a nuance, but I think that's a fair point.
All right. So let's talk a little bit more about Grasshopper and a great success story. What are some of the learnings that came out of that as it relates to the sales and marketing aspect?
Yes, I think Grasshopper is a great case study in sales and marketing alignment. So as I mentioned earlier, Grasshopper targeted very small businesses. Our sales process was all online. So everything we did was to drive customers to our website to sign up for a paid plan from day one. So we didn't have free trials. We did have a customer support function and people would call to ask questions, but all sales happened online. And this was back in the, we'll call it the 2010s. The SaaS playbook at that point was find a customer segment, sell to them, target bigger customers, hire a sales force, go up market. This was the way everybody did it, right? This is how you got VC money. This is how everything worked at the time. We didn't believe any of that. So we looked at our customers and we said, there are a lot of these customers. We're a very lean organization. We can make a lot of money selling to these customers at $35 a month. A lot of our competitors can't, right? Because they either have higher overhead, large investors that require different returns, all kinds of reasons. But in our particular case, we could be a highly profitable company and grow. And so we knew that was our market. We knew that our whole service and our whole sales process was about making sign up, as we refer to it, easy and painless. We were dealing with one person making one decision. We didn't deal with committees of people deciding things or complex purchasing processes or demos or presentations or anything like that. So we understood this. This was core to everything that we did. A number of times, things came up. Hey, we have this customer that wants physical phones. We should probably offer physical phones. And we'd say, well, does that really fit with our target market? Does that really fit? And it didn't. And so we came up with a really simple rule. If any prospect ever wanted to talk to the same person twice during the sales process, they were not our customer, which is an interesting way to think about it. So they could call support, they could ask questions. But if they ever talked to Joe and thought Joe was their salesperson and they wanted Joe to take them out to lunch or Joe to show them a presentation or Joe to show them a demo, that was not the way we worked. And so that became a really interesting litmus test for us to ensure that we kept that alignment, that we didn't change markets without changing our sales process. And so everything was focused in that, towards that market and towards that motion.
And who purchased Grasshopper?
Grasshopper was purchased by Citrix. And then Citrix actually divested the division that bought Grasshopper to LogMeIn. And then LogMeIn, I think, got bought by a PE firm. So Grasshopper's been through a few different owners in the last decade.
It has. And this brings up another interesting thought, which is, and I'm using my own terms here.
Sure.
So there are some companies that are features and there are some companies that are functions. And what I mean by that is a company that is a core function, which is if it's say B2B, it's like I provide like the core operating software for, you know, SAP, for example, or let's take maybe Salesforce is a better example that people might recognize. That's like a core function of a company is like CRM. And then if I create a chat service, that's really more of a feature where now Salesforce can buy Slack and incorporate that into the function, which is the CRM system. So when you tell me that we had a simple mnemonic, which was simply, if a potential customer has to talk to the same salesperson twice, that's not a customer of ours. So were you thinking of Grasshopper as more of a feature that then would be purchased by someone that had more of a function where they could integrate our feature into their core function? You said we're only going after $35 a month. We're going after the target market of the small firm that basically operated remote. So that's a pretty defined market. And if you ever wanted to become the next big telephone company, you're obviously going to have to add more bells and whistles and, yes, and do big enterprise deals and that sort of thing. So were you always thinking, we're really happy with this feature and we can build a really nice business, a really profitable business. And then someday when we want to monetize, we'll just sell to another company where we're just a feature on their main function.
That is how we kind of thought about it at the highest level. We never really had the intention of becoming, as was referred to at the time, a unified communications company that was somebody that would sell to these larger enterprises and provide chat and video conferencing and all those other things that are included in really the unified communications market. Again, that wasn't our skill set. Our skill set and really our brand was really tied to this micro and small business and just helping them get done what they had to get done in the simplest way possible. Again, I think that's one of the things too that people feel like, wow, that's really limiting and really narrow. And it is really narrow, but focus wins. And that market is big enough that had we not even sold that business unit, I don't know specifically, but if I were to guess, it's probably a $100 million business at this point. And it's a $100 million business doing 20, 25% net margin. And so the way we thought about it, it was a great business. And we didn't really see the need to go beyond that.
There are a lot of companies that are started today that are started clearly with the intention of, we want to sell out to somebody at some point. And I don't know if that was your case when Grasshopper was being started, but it seems like since you were so focused on, we're in this target market, we're making $25, $35 million a year in revenue, we've got really nice profit margins, and that's great. And then someday when we want to monetize, we'll sell to a bigger company. So that helped you stay focused to know who you are. And I think that helps marketing be aligned with sales to know, we're not trying to be the unified communications company or the unified telecom company. We know our market. And so marketing, go after it, and we can stay focused on that. So it all gets back to know who you are, know who you want to be, and stay focused on that.
I have a lot of thoughts, more than how we have time for, on running a business to be profitable and growing or running a business to be sold. I firmly believe you're always better off building a good business that's profitable and can grow on its own. There are people who are very lucky who sell quickly and make huge exits on trends or on other kind of market dynamics. But I think that over time, and I'll age myself a little bit, right? Having lived through the dot-coms and all the different booms and busts that have happened since then, the one thing that I've seen be true through all of that is growing profitable businesses always return to favor. They're not always in favor, because if you're not growing at 150%, sometimes you're not in favor. Over the long run, those businesses always end up in favor. And at Grasshopper, we were never building to be sold. In fact, truth be told, the first call or meeting that we had with the potential acquirer was literally just showed up on my calendar one December Friday afternoon. I thought, what is this? So it was not our strategy. We wanted to build a good company that was profitable and that provided a good service for its customers and a good life for the people.
I love that too, because to me, it's about the intention. What's the intention behind this business? What are we trying to do? And if the intention is, let's build a nice business that has wonderful customers, we're solving problems for people, or we're creating opportunities as a result of our service. And if that leads to a big exit, wonderful. And that's great for everybody. But to go into it with, I'm going to see what the hot new thing is today, and I'm going to slap something together and throw some money at it and see if I can get the attention of a bigger company and hope that I can cash out right away. I mean, yeah, people do that. We know all the time, but I'm with you. It's like, let's build something meaningful. Yeah. And at the end of the day, we're going to get rewarded for that too. I do want to ask you about AI. We can't not talk about AI. Sure. That's obviously on people's minds these days. So tell me how you think artificial intelligence is going to impact sales and marketing. Are you seeing any interesting applications these days of AI in the sales and marketing area?
I do see some really interesting applications in the online marketing area, particularly when it comes to content and SEO. AI can write content really well, content that's really well targeted and very readable and very informative for customers and prospects and other people. There are definitely some things you have to do to make that work. And, you know, there's some kind of nuances to it. But I think that it is a microcosm for what I see, certainly over the next few years. Beyond that, who knows, I guess, what the tipping point or whatever they're saying they're calling it, where AI is in charge and people aren't, is coming at some point in the next
the
10 years.
Singularity.
Singularity, sorry. So again, who knows what happens after that, but I feel like AI can be a very effective tool to help the execution of strategies, the execution of some of the tactics. I don't see it at the point yet where it can decide what to do or perhaps how you reach that target market it can help with, but I still see it as an execution, arms and legs, as opposed to a strategic agent, I guess is how I think about it. So like I said, I think that the SEO content is an interesting application. It's really stunning to me when you read content that's written by AI and how well it's written. I mean, that's a game changer for SEO because you can produce tons of content at scale.
Well, and I agree with that. And I'm a huge fan of AI and all the things that it can do. The thing that gives me a little bit of pause, though, is maybe there's a short-term advantage to people who are first movers with this AI on the content piece, because it's so easy to create content with AI. And we're already flooded with content before ChatGPT came out. And so now if we're going to have 100x more content because it's so easy and cheap to produce, then it's just going to devalue that. And so I think the smart people are now thinking, okay, I've got AI, and how can I use AI to make me an even better content producer and creator and marketer in such a way where my humanness, I can add that to the equation that's going to give me an advantage over some AI content mill that is just spitting out a whole bunch of content and hoping something's going to stick out there. So I think you still can't take the human out of this, but the AI can absolutely be a huge accelerator of our humanness. But if we take the heart out of the content, I think we're going to lose a lot here. We're going to lose that engagement with the reader, because I think a lot of us can still spot something that's written by AI. Now, of course, it's going to get better, but
I think you're right about that. And I think the other area related to this, kind of lead source attribution, and how that's such an area that's very difficult to know what actually influenced somebody to purchase something, especially online. I think AI is going to change that. That is a solvable question. It's just one of those problems that has sort of end by end complexity and makes it really hard to figure out manually, but that's exactly what AI can do. So I actually think the next, maybe not the next, but something you will see in the online marketing world is much better attribution models that are based on AI technology.
Excellent. Well, Mike, is there anything else that you want to mention here before we wrap up? And if folks want to connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
I really appreciate being on today. Probably the best way to contact me is by email. My email is mike@kettleholepartners.com. And that's really the best way.
Excellent. All right, Mike, thanks for being on the show.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Now, I have a question for you. How are you going to implement and benefit from the ideas that you hear on our show? Well, we would love to have a conversation with you about that. So please visit us at ceocoachinginternational.com. We can then set up a call and we can talk about how we can help you make big happen in your business. Thanks, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you.